it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, escalating tensions after a reported chemical attack in Syria. It's brought the eyes of the world back to that war-torn country. As President Trump threatens military action against the Syrian government, one UN official says it's the civilian population that needs urgent attention.
On the humanitarian side, this is the worst we have seen since the conflict started 8 years ago. Multiple displacement, air attacks, reported chemicals. Civilians don't know where to go anymore.
Then,
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain.
They wrote some of the most popular musicals of all time. How Rodgers and Hammerstein revolutionized Broadway. But first, Panos Moumtsis, the UN's regional humanitarian coordinator for Syria. Panos Moumtsis, how wonderful to see you again.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks, Diane.
What can you tell us about the reported chemical weapon attack in the town of Douma? What do you hear from people on the ground there?
Well, in Douma, there's been reports that came up from medical centers and medical staff saying that all the evidence are there that indicates that there could have been use of chlorine that had taken place.
Interesting, you said there could have been. There is no proof yet. Is that correct?
Well, there isn't. The United Nations Secretary General has asked for an investigation to take place to be able really to bring the evidence on the ground. But what is really happening in Isota is very sad because there were about 400,000 people who have been there besieged since 2013. Where the area was completely surrounded, so we couldn't really bring in humanitarian assistance except with a special permission occasionally. No medical supplies, particularly our trauma kits and other, were able to be brought in. Of course, during the last few weeks, we have seen heavy hostilities, bombing taking place, massive evacuations. Over 140,000 people have left, some to Damascus. Some have gone to Idlib in the northwest of the country. And of course, Douma now remains the last city inside Izghouta, where evacuations have also started. It's very traumatic for people who have lived their entire life to all of a sudden leave, but with the clothes they're wearing, to an unknown destination.
Tell me why you believe the town of Douma was targeted.
Well, Douma, like the rest of Izghouta, is an area which was really taken over by opposition. There were fighters. There was really held for quite some time. And, I mean, the besiegement that took place for quite some time also meant that no food or assistance was coming in. For us, the basic rule of war is that military should fight with military. Fighters should fight with fear. That's the whole Geneva Convention and what we really learned after World War I and World War II. Sadly, what we see in Syria is that civilians are being caught up in the middle. When urban areas are bombed, when the children have to go and hide in basements for weeks developing skin problems and really the fear and the trauma, that's unacceptable. When you have health hospitals, health facilities, ambulances, medical staff who are bombed and targeted, that's unacceptable. And we have seen in Syria a very high number of incidents where hospitals systematically got attacked. That constitutes, if proven that this was done on purpose, it is a war crime.
What do you believe Bashar al-Assad's ultimate goal is? Is it to wipe out the population that disagrees with his policies? It would seem that, indeed, the civilians are the ones who have been targeted.
Well, there is obviously a political aim to regain control for the totality of the country. And there's been different opposition groups, different views, different... I mean, Syria itself also has been a country with so much proxy interference from various actors from all over. So really, it's a country where the people have tremendously suffered because of this interference from many actors, really not just within Syria, but also from outside. From our perspective, it's sad to see the country really at the moment is divided in different areas. And what we try to do as United Nations with the NGO partners is to bring humanitarian assistance either from within Syria or through cross-border from Turkey, from Jordan, from Iraq. The aim is to reach the civilians, to reach the people with what they need.
And how successful has that humanitarian effort been?
It is a massive humanitarian effort. At the moment, we are reaching about 7.5 million people every month through multiple means. And you know, Diane, when I go around and ask the Syrian people, women, families, what do you need the most? Is it food? Is it medical supplies? Is it shelter? The answer is always the same. It's protection. What we really are needing the most is safety, is really to feel like us and our loved ones, we can be in a place where we're not bombed, where we're not targeted, where we can live a normal life.
And yet, from the images I've seen on television, it's as though areas have been totally destroyed.
Entire towns were totally destroyed. If we look into parts of East Ghouta today, but even Raqqa, I mean, the question we ask ourselves with the war on terror is, does one need to destroy almost an entire city to take it over? Is there no other way to really move to a peaceful solution? What we would like to see is a cessation of hostilities. We would like to see a peaceful negotiation where an agreement comes by all parties to a way forward, where people do not have to suffer.
What would that agreement look like, and who would you believe would be the best participants?
Well, the United Nations has a political process through Mr. Stéphane de Mistura in Geneva, who is a Secretary General envoy. Unfortunately, this process so far has not brought the expected results, despite the multiple rounds and the efforts to bring it together. They're working on constitution, they're working on elections. For us on the humanitarian side, we really feel we're a little bit like the fire brigade that goes to set off a fire. But what you really need to address is the root cause of the issue. And the root cause is the political situation that needs to be resolved, which unfortunately, despite now we're on the eighth year of the conflict, it still continues with no near view of when would it end or how would it look.
So you have some 700,000 Syrians displaced just this year. Half the entire population has been displaced over the course of the war. Where are they? Where are they living? How are they managing? Are countries willing to accept them?
So the numbers are really staggering. 5.5 million Syrians have become refugees in the neighboring countries. In Lebanon, which has 4 million population, there is 1 million Syrians.
Ah.
Imagine, I mean, it's when I visit the Bekaa Valley areas at the border with Syria and Lebanon, many villages and communities have more Syrian refugees than nationals. And yet, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, what we've seen is an incredible generosity. They've opened their schools to Syrian refugee children. They've opened their health facilities. They've opened their hearts, their homes, to help and to really offer that hospitality, which is so genuine in this region. Now, 7-8 years on, of course, this hospitality, we start seeing the signs of a fatigue because the resources are very limited and people have to share, governments, local municipalities have to share what little they have. When you go to a classroom that has 60-80 children in it, because, of course, the head teacher and the teachers will not say no to any child that needs to go to school. They accept them all, but the consequence is really a huge pressure on the resources on the neighboring countries. The international community, of course, helps, but the help that is given in no way meets the needs on the ground.
Do you believe that the assistance that countries like Lebanon, like Turkey, that assistance is going to come to an end. I mean, how many more refugees can these countries take in?
Indeed. I mean, the capacity of the neighboring countries is stretched to the maximum, and also the resources are very limited, which makes it extremely difficult. At the same time, what is really important is that to look at inside Syria, and the position of the United Nations is that the conditions inside are not right for the return of refugees right now. So this means that the neighboring countries will need to continue hosting the refugees, I mean, vast numbers, millions of people, until the situation inside comes to a point where people can voluntarily start going back. Most Syrians, when we ask them, they have a very strong affiliation to their country, to their land, to their history, to their culture. And all of them say, we want to go back, but we don't feel it's safe yet. We don't feel right away. There is a tremendous dignity. I'll never forget in a refugee camp in Jordan, seeing an old man struggling to carry these bags and assistance of rice and food to take it back to his tent. And I said to him, are you alone? Do you have, you know, can we help you? Do you have your children? He says, of course, I have my sons. And I said, but shouldn't they be here to help you? And there was a pause. There was a pause, and he looked at me and said, in my village, I was helping others. I don't want my children to see me receiving assistance. I don't. And this really strong sense of dignity.
And pride.
And pride, absolutely. That it was all about them feeling like really very unhappy with where they have ended up, and feeling that this man was saying, I was the one helping other people in my village. And now lining up, I don't want my grandchildren to see me lining up to receive assistance. I cannot do that. I'd rather carry things on my own.
The international community is going to meet in Brussels later this month. What do you expect from that meeting?
In 2 weeks' time, we're going to Brussels for the Syria conference. It's a ministerial level. It's a high level. A number of countries around the world are coming. We want to see, first of all, financial pledges to help us with the appeal. I mean, we were asking for $3.5 billion to provide humanitarian assistance inside Syria and $4.5 billion to the neighboring countries. It's a massive ask, but it's really to be able to provide the bare minimum in terms of assistance to the people inside Syria. We would be presenting our humanitarian emergency plans, and at the moment we have multiple fronts where we provide emergency assistance in Izghouta, in the northwest in Idlib, in Afrin, in Raqqa, in Deir ez-Zor. We would be also asking for access. One of the biggest issues we have is to be able to reach people in need. At the moment, there is 2.3 million Syrians who live in what we call hard-to-reach and besieged areas. Areas which require an explicit authorization for us as humanitarians to bring in very basic life-saving assistance. And that we don't have. In 2017, we only managed to deliver 27% of the assistance to these areas. In 2018, only 5% of the needs in these hard-to-reach and besieged areas have been met because of the politics, because of permissions, and even when we go, a number of medical items like trauma kits or chlorine tablets for water chlorination and so on are not allowed to go through this, systematically taken out, which makes it, of course, really hard for us to do our job.
Tell me what or how you see the role of Russia in this entire conflict.
Russia plays a key role, really close ally to the government of Syria, together with Iran. We talk to everybody. We talk to Russia as well. Their role is vital to ensure some of the basic minimum international humanitarian standards take place. On the humanitarian side, we always go to Russia, for example, to ask to facilitate in terms of access to these hard-to-reach and besieged areas. We bring up systematically issues. We talk to everybody who can have influence to bring change all the parties, basically. So Russia is a key actor.
And yet Russia, as Putin certainly declares his support for Bashar al-Assad.
There is indeed a political alignment in there. In my work as a humanitarian workers, we work on all sides of the conflict, and we really try to keep this balance. So we have assistance and programs for displaced people in government-held areas. We have programs cross-border in opposition-held areas. And that's a very difficult balance to keep in a very politicized operation. We are guided by humanitarian principles. We're guided by the principle of impartiality, neutrality, independence, most importantly, humanity.
You're also guided by the principle of hope, it seems to me. How do you see it?
Hope is very important, and that's the most difficult question that we get asked, where Syrian people, despite everything that goes on, what I'm always amazed is about their resilience, picking the pieces and moving on. Life has to continue. And of course, when you see the young generation, when you see the children, we have to do everything we can to give them a hope, to give them a better life to the future. At the moment, the country is going through an extraordinary situation. On the humanitarian side, this is the worst we have seen since the conflict started 8 years ago. Multiple displacement, air attacks, reported chemicals, you name it, really. I mean, the violations that have taken place, attacks on hospitals, attacks on schools, attacks on markets. Civilians don't know where to go anymore.
And they're fleeing everywhere in anticipation of something even worse coming.
A few weeks ago, there was an attack that took place in Idlib market, an airstrike. People had gone to the market to buy vegetables, to buy their needs for their households. An airstrike took to the market, resulting to dozens of people who were either killed or injured. Some of the injured people rushed them in cars, in taxis, in trucks, and whatever they could to the nearby hospital, except the hospital itself was bombed 2 hours later. So the survivors of the market attack, who then was re-bombed again one more time. And this is a real story. This is really things that have happened inside. And this is where the sense of desperation of people, I often get the question from Syrians who say, is the world not watching? Is the world not listening? Is there really nothing that can be done to help us to bring an end to this carnage, to bring an end to this extreme situation we have to go through on a daily basis?
Panos, is there anything else you would like to say?
As humanitarian workers, we feel that, you know, when you watch the news, often the news on Syria come with a warning at the beginning. And the warning says that the pictures are too graphic. They warn the viewers about what they're going to see. Somehow the pictures are too graphic for the public, but it seems or it feels like they're not graphic enough for politicians conscious to be able to bring a change, to be able to bring an end to this situation, which really has a dramatic impact on people's lives.
Panos Mumpsis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Todd Purdom is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, a senior writer at Politico. But today he joins me to talk about his new book, Something Wonderful, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Broadway revolution. Todd Purdom, it's great to see you.
Such a pleasure to be here, Diane.
Really, after all those years being here in Washington, covering politics, covering what was happening around the country, what in the world led you to write this book?
Well, the people who know me know that these are the songs I grew up with, the songs my parents played when I was a kid and my brother and sister and I were growing up. And I've always loved this music and the music of the Great American Songbook. So when it came time to write the next book, my publisher was asking me for my ideas, and I was struggling to come up with one, but my wife, Dee Dee Meyer, said, this is what you should write about. This is what you care about. And they immediately said yes. So for the past 3.5 years, that's what I've been doing.
Wow. And I presume it was great fun.
It was great fun. I spent a lot of time here in Washington at the Library of Congress in Oscar Hammerstein's papers, and Richard Rodgers' musical scores are here. His letters and papers are at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center in New York. And finding the, you know, original drafts of these songs and stories in those guys' own handwriting and watching the process by which they refined and honed down the words and the music was really a thrill.
Tell me how that collaboration came about.
Their collaboration was really the result of a kind of a midlife crisis for both of them. Oscar Hammerstein, who'd been a huge success on Broadway in the 1920s, especially with Showboat, which he wrote with Jerome Kern, had 12 straight years of flops in New York and London and a very disappointing string of movies in Hollywood. Whereas Richard Rodgers, who'd had a really unbroken success more than 20 years on Broadway with his partner Lorenz Hart, Hart was becoming incapacitated by alcoholism, and he'd lost the will to work and, in some profound way, the will to live. So when Rodgers was approached by the Theater Guild about adapting a somewhat little-known play called Green Grow the Lilacs, Larry Hart wasn't interested, and Rodgers turned to Oscar, and it was that play, which is really about nothing more important than which of two guys takes a girl to a party, that became Oklahoma, their first collaboration.
You know, I do want us to hear some of Oklahoma, but first I want to know how they collaborated. Did they sit in a room together? Did they talk on the phone together? What did they do?
Well, they sat in a room together when they were outlining the show and when they were thinking about how it should be organized, what the characters would do. They definitely had face-to-face meetings for that. But when it came down to the business of composing, Oscar Hammerstein almost always worked at his farm in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, in Bucks County, or at his townhouse in Manhattan, whereas Rodgers worked in his Manhattan apartment or his own Connecticut country house, and Hammerstein wrote the words first about 90% of the time, and he would send them off by messenger or mail, or sometimes he'd dictate them on the phone. And Hammerstein slaved over the words. He took weeks and days, whereas Rodgers, after he'd been thinking about this for a long time, typically would write the tune in 5 or 10 minutes, which drove Hammerstein crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's hear the opening song from their first collaboration, Oklahoma.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way.
Todd, this song has just such a positive, wonderful, uplifting feel.
Yes, it is. It is really, you can see the sunlight shimmering over the corn, practically. It was the first words that Oscar gave to Richard Rodgers, who famously said, well, you'd have to be made of concrete not to spark to that. And in some ways, it set the pattern for their collaboration.
Beautiful morning, oh, what a beautiful day.
You know, what surprises me most about this is that the optimism about this show, was not there.
No, it was. They had a terrible time raising money because the show had no stars, no chorus girls, no big opening number. It opened with this number and a woman churning butter on the stage and the cowboy singing in the wings. Both Rodgers and Hammerstein described making the rounds of the penthouse circuit in Manhattan, cup in hand, singing, having the stars sing these songs, and they would come away from two or three of these sessions without a penny raised. So there was a great deal of skepticism when it was getting ready to open. The opening night audience was not full in the St. James Theater. Not at all. Not at all. But the next morning, the reviews were so splendid that there was a policeman struggling to maintain order at the box office, and the line stretched around the block.
Oh, how wonderful.
And it sold out for the next 4 years.
4 years? Yes. Oh, my gosh. That sounds like Hamilton.
It does sound like Hamilton. And in some ways, it was just as radical and innovative in its day as Hamilton was on Broadway in 2015.
How do you mean that?
Well, it broke the mold. It was so much deeper and richer than most of the Broadway fare of its day that people, in its quietness, in its naturalism. Now, Hamilton, of course, was remarkable for its genre-bending use of hip-hop and other musical idioms to tell a story. But remember, a very serious story about the Founding Fathers. So Oklahoma was nominally about, you know, Indian territory becoming a state in 1906, 1907. But to World War II wartime audiences, what they heard was not just the courage and determination it took to settle the frontier, but that it would take to win the war.
You're saying that that is what you call the subtext.
Yes, or the overtone, or how it was received in the popular culture. And it also helps explain why it was such a big hit. In every audience, there were rows of servicemen who were preparing to ship out from New York, mostly to Europe, of course. And the fire department would bend the rules sometimes and let soldiers stand in the wings backstage so they could see the show. And people got a sense that in the song The Farmer and the Cowman, let's all behave ourselves and act like brothers. In a way, you don't want to be too heavy-handed about it, but I think at a time when people were thinking about what the Allied victory would look like, whether the United Nations might be a parliament of man in which people could finally end war, the optimistic spirit of this show really helped buoy wartime audiences.
I gather one of your favorite productions is South Pacific.
Yes, and I suppose it's the journalist in me that likes that show because it's what we'd call today a rip-from-the-headlines play. It came just 4 years after the war. Virtually every member of the audience would have had some connection to World War II, either service himself or knowing someone who did. It's also a highly charged, politically relevant, topical story about racial tolerance or racial intolerance, the story of Nellie Forbush, the Navy nurse from Arkansas who falls in love with a French planter, and she's shocked because he has mixed-race children. Then there's the young Princetonian Marine Lieutenant Cable from Philadelphia who falls in love with a Tonkinese girl and can't bring himself to imagine taking her home to the main line no matter how much he loves her. So for me, in some ways, I can imagine what that would have been like as a kind of moment on Broadway that spoke to the whole country in the aftermath of an overwhelming mutual experience like the war. And also Oscar Hammerstein himself was very politically active and involved. So I think for me, I have to say that's probably my favorite show.
There is a very romantic song that comes out of that.
Yes, the great Metropolitan Opera basso. And of course, in some ways, this song is a reflection of Oscar Hammerstein's own instantaneous attraction to his second wife, Dorothy, with whom he more or less fell in love at first sight on a ship to England. Pinza was making his Broadway debut. His English was terrible, So early in the rehearsals, when Joshua Logan, the director, was supervising, he kept singing Some Exchanged Evening. And they said, no, Ezio, you have to say Enchanted. So then it became Enchanted Evening. But one of the cast members, Don Fellows, who played a minor role in the show, said that when the chorus would be standing backstage and Pinza would sing this song, they could feel their feet vibrate on the stage floor. His voice was so powerful.
This happened to me.
And I think one of the things, you know, sometimes people mock this song as sentimental and impossible, but Oscar Hammerstein knew that it was possible, and I think he's also not saying you won't necessarily fall in love instantly, but if you see something that you love, don't wait around and think it'll come again. Go for it and take a chance and make your heart open to the risk, and I think that's really the meaning of the song.
Really?
Never let her go. Once you have found her, never let her go.
Just gorgeous. You know, we should say that that was based on the novel by James Michener.
Yes, who had himself been in the Navy in the war. And so that had won the Pulitzer Prize in 1949, just as they were working on the show. So, again, it's a reflection of something that's it's would be like making a musical out of the most vibrant current event you could imagine. Although, of course, sadly, in the country today, it's hard to imagine an event that would be so unifying as World War II had been for America then.
I had the privilege of interviewing James Michener many, many years ago. What a charming man he was.
Yes, no, and this show changed his life. He had been a textbook editor at Macmillan
right.
and Company,
right.
and he came back from the war, and Rodgers and Hammerstein knew that he didn't have a lot of cash, so they advanced him $5,000 to buy a small percentage of the show. And it was the rewards from that that enabled him to quit his day job and become a full-time writer for the rest of his life.
How wonderful. This next song, however, is something that explores the source of racism. It's You've Got to Be Carefully Taught.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made, and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught.
Tell me what this song is all about.
Well, of course, it's about the learned nature of racism, that it's not born in you innately. That's what Lieutenant Cable tries to explain. He tries to explain how, you know, he can't help it in a sense because this is what he was taught to think and feel. But it was very controversial at the time. Some of the country's most sophisticated critics didn't like it, thought it didn't belong in a Broadway musical. The New Yorker said it's just a little bit embarrassing.
Thought it was too political.
Too political. The Saturday Review of Literature said it smacks of dragged-in didacticism. And when the show premiered out of town in New Haven, a naval officer wrote Oscar Hammerstein saying, "It's like swallowing an ice cube in the middle of your scotch, and you could not have interrupted the more beautiful flow of entertainment if you'd stopped for a VD lecture." And Hammerstein wrote back saying, "I think the point is that this is still a problem."
It is even today still a problem.
Well, when South Pacific was revived at Lincoln Center Theater in 2008 in the middle of the campaign, let's just say it seemed a highly relevant topic even then.
Indeed. And isn't Oklahoma about to come back to Broadway.
Oklahoma is having a production in Brooklyn at St. Anne's Warehouse this fall, but Carousel is opening on Broadway right as we speak, and that's another sign of the enduring appeal of these shows.
But these political messages have totally endured through the years.
No, it's what makes Rodgers and Hammerstein's works last so long. There are great songs from the 20s and 30s that are still played in cabarets and jazz clubs and are the staple of, you know, great artists still. But the shows from which those songs came were fluffy, frothy plots that, you know, boy meets girl and mistaken identity and musical beds and all kinds of things. And those have not lasted, and they're basically unrevivable. Whereas almost all of Rodgers and Hammerstein's shows, or the Big Five hits, are constantly in circulation from high schools to dinner theaters to Broadway and London. And I think it's really Oscar Hammerstein's work as a dramatist that sets this team apart. I mean, obviously, Rodgers' music is spectacularly beautiful, but it's the depth and realism of the stories that endures.
Todd, tell me how your parents talked about these wonderful musicals.
Well, they exposed us to them, and my father's older brother was an actor in New York who had actually appeared in the original production of How to Succeed in Broadway, replacing Charles Nelson Reilly as Bud Frump, the scheming nephew. So they introduced us to Broadway pretty young. I remember the first really professional theatrical production I saw was in 1968 with Celeste Holm in a touring company of MAME in Chicago. And standing in the forecourt of the Schubert Theater with my parents, I looked at the publicity photos and said to them, "Oh, no, it's in black and white?" And they said, "No, it's live on the stage with real people." And so from the minute the overture started and the play began, I was hooked. And 50 years later, I still am.
So exciting. Rodgers and Hammerstein often featured strong female characters, but there were some problems in how they characterized their gender.
Yes, I mean, they're creatures of their time. They're men of their time. The plays are of their moment. Carousel is probably the most dramatic case in point, and it's being tested now in this revival. It's a play in which the hero or the anti-hero beats his wife and then hits his daughter when he comes back from heaven to try to make things right. So it's very uncomfortable, and the only thing that can be said is, at the end of the day, the strongest character in that play is Julie Jordan, his wife, who sticks by her guns, raises her daughter, prevails, and he, sadly, checks out, commits suicide, and can't face the realities of life. So while there is a brutality to his character, he's not the one who's the strongest one. He's the weak one. And in some ways, I think, while it makes audiences uncomfortable, and it did then, Rodgers and Hammerstein are certainly not endorsing spousal abuse. They're just, I think, portraying the complexities of a painful relationship, of which, sadly, we know there are too many examples.
And in this age of Me Too, how do you think that's going to play on Broadway?
Well, I think the producers and creators of the current revival are concerned about that, and they've changed the line slightly so that when...
The line being...
Is it the daughter asked the mother, is it possible for someone to hit you and have it not hurt at all? And in the original, the mother answers, yes, it is. And in this one, the mother just remains painfully silent, and the daughter...
I see.
So...
So they do change that. You know, Todd, I was fascinated that you actually began the book with Cinderella, the production on television. Why did you do that?
Well, for two reasons, because I wanted to try to paint a picture of what Rodgers and Hammerstein were like at the peak of their powers, at the peak of their financial and commercial and creative success. And that struck me as really the best example of how dominant they were across the culture, because that program, airing for a single 90 minutes on CBS on March 31st, 1957, the 14th anniversary of the opening of Oklahoma, was seen by 107 million people. The country was 172 million people. So not even really the Super Bowl gets that kind of an audience today.
And somebody said that if you walked out on the street
in New York
that night, you probably wouldn't have seen anyone.
The streets were deserted because, as he said, everybody was inside watching the show.
But, you know, that is such an important point, that we were all drawn together to watch something on television. that we would all then talk about. Not today.
No, that sense of community really doesn't exist anymore, and the culture, pop culture, and every other aspect is much more fractionated and divided. So I think one of the things I also wanted to capture was Rodgers and Hammerstein's dominance across the cultural landscape, from Broadway to Hollywood to television, which after all in 1957 was still a pretty new medium that a lot of intellectuals looked down on. They were more than thrilled to try to do this because, as someone figured out, the number of people who saw that musical would have filled a Broadway theater every night for something like 165 years.
Wow. Extraordinary. Now, let's talk about their last and maybe most famous collaboration, The Sound of Music. And I must say, in my mind, of course, is Julie Andrews. But on stage was Mary Martin.
My day in the hills has come to an end, I know. A star has come out to tell me it's time to go. But deep in the dark green shadows are voices that urge me to stay. So I pause and I wait and I listen for one more sound, for one more lovely thing that the hills might say. The hills are alive the sound of music, with songs they have sung for a thousand years. The hills fill my heart with the sound of music. My heart wants to sing every song it hears.
Such a different sound from that of Julie Andrews.
Yes. Well, one thing we have to remember is that Mary Martin was almost 46 years old when she played this young postulant, and those were the conventions of theater that older actors could play younger characters. But interestingly, Oscar Hammerstein, after the Broadway production of The Sound of Music, said he never again wanted the role to be played by anything but genuinely young women, and he was quite concerned about that. He was worried that even Doris Day might be too old to make the movie.
Who chose Julie Andrews?
Well, I think by that point, Julie Andrews had become such a star with Mary Poppins. It was really the director, Robert Wise, of the movie who chose Julie Andrews. But, of course, she had a pre-existing relationship with Rodgers and Hammerstein. Hammerstein was dead by that point because of Cinderella. And I think they thought she was the absolute natural choice.
I must tell you that every Christmas, for years and years, on Christmas night, the kids would get into our bed and we would watch.
Once more.
But didn't the critics hate it?
They hated the play, and they hated the movie even more.
Why? Well,
they said it was treacly and sentimental and a return to operetta, and it was old-fashioned and backward-looking and not revolutionary like their early works. But Oscar Hammerstein was disappointed on the first night because the reviews were bad. But the second night, they returned to the show, and he told his collaborators, make no mistake, look at this audience. The audience doesn't lie. This is a smash hit. And indeed it was. And the soundtrack of the movie and the original cast album from the Broadway recording were together the biggest selling albums of all time, remaining on the charts for longer than the Beatles or Elvis Presley ever did.
Todd Purdom, what would you say is their legacy?
Well, I think the legacy of Oscar Hammerstein is that he knew how to write about real people with real concerns and develop their character through the combination of song, story, and dance. And cartoons became irrelevant in his world. These were realistic characters that you and I might meet, and he and Richard Rodgers used the music and words to really explore their souls and let us see the inner workings of their thoughts and feelings.
I can't let you go without asking how you, now out of Washington and mostly on the West Coast, except, as you said, to write this book. Tell me, from your perspective out there, how you see what's going on in Washington as a former political reporter.
Well, of course, it's an amazing story, and my colleagues are doing a fantastic job of covering the daily, you know, grind and chaos, frankly, of this administration and of Washington in general. It's a little bit scary to be far removed from it. Sometimes when you're in Washington, you get so caught up in the moment, the day-to-dayness, that you don't really see the perspective. In a way, being farther away is almost more upsetting because you don't get the same immersion, so you have a little more time to think about what it all means. But I think we're going through a dark and difficult time in our politics. It might get worse before it gets better. I just wish we had a Rodgers and Hammerstein around to help us get through it.
What a wonderful way to end this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Diane, for having me. I really appreciate it.
And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. That number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereen.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Douglas Bell and Danielle Brown. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Reed.